Thank you for coming back. Let me start by reading a well-known section just as preface to what I need to say this afternoon. Revelation chapter 13. It says, talks about beasts and horns and all the rest, and it says, "And to it the dragon gave his power and his throne and great authority. One of its heads seemed to have a mortal wound, but its mortal wound was healed, and the whole earth followed the beast with wonder. Men worshipped the dragon," Satan, "for he had given his authority to the beast, and they worshipped the beast, saying, 'Who is like the beast, and who can fight against it?'" Seventh Adventists have been pretty clear for most of our history on who this power is, but I don't think our understanding is as fixed as I used to imagine. I can remember when I first started in this job, one of the old religious liberty guys, who I won't name, nice guy, but he scared me by coming to me and sitting down and giving me a talk, and he said, "You know, when Ellen White wrote what she wrote in Great Controversy, according to what God told her, events would have happened very quickly, and that Rome would fill this role of the beast that the dragon had given his power to, and he would persecute the saints and all the rest." He says, "But in this new model," he says, "in this delay time," he said, "they're going to be our ally against secularism." I still see that fellow, and I haven't quizzed him lately, but I have a feeling he's changed. But a number of Adventists, I think, of recent years, and perhaps even to the present time, have been, if not deluded, then disarmed into thinking that the Roman Catholic power is not what it was seen to be by the Reformers. And it's worth reminding ourselves what's really going on. Back a few weeks now, on September 24, I went along with about 55,000 other friends. No, they weren't my friends, but there were about 55,000 people gathered there in the front. I always think of it as the back, though, of the Capitol. And we listened and watched on big videotrons as Francis I, the Pope of Rome, spoke to the joint session of Congress. Now, I think most everybody knows how important this was, a significant event, but maybe not everyone is quite aware of how truly significant a historic moment it is. There's been a few other people that have spoken to joint sessions of Congress. The Marquis de Lafayette technically did, but in reality he spoke separately to Congress and the Senate. He was a great friend of the United States. The last king of Hawaii did, shortly before his kingdom disappeared. Who else? There'd not been very many. I remember Boris Yeltsin speaking to the joint session, and a little bit after he sent the tanks out to take pot shots at his own parliament building. But there's not been very many. Even Netanyahu's speech recently was very contentious, if you remember. Probably should have never happened. A little bit before Pope Francis was asked to speak, there was an invitation extended to the Dalai Lama, and it was immediately countered, and it was said to be so contentious. He was such a contentious figure, it was not allowed. Well, then next, the Pope of Rome. I think the quick answer why Francis was both invited and it was approved was that the then majority leader speaker, Representative Boehner, is a Roman Catholic, and the minority leader, Nancy Pelosi, is a Roman Catholic. So it suited both of them individually to have their church leaders speak to Congress. But it was very improper. And what I've said many, many times in Liberty, written it in Liberty, is that this is the worst type of guest to have to Congress. Here, the United States, a rather unique government set up to have the power of the people presented. That's a direct result of the Enlightenment and of Protestant thinking. But most particularly, the separation of church and state. defines the United States, and it certainly is absent in most countries around the world. Islamic countries, for example, are radically the opposite. There's never to be any separation of church and state. And here we have, with the Pope of Rome, the head of a little 100-plus acre principality, he claims to be a head of state and also the head of a church. And so it seems to me this was the worst signal for America to throw by announcing this man to speak and to give him the platform. Then he came. And I'll never forget standing out back, as I said, great air of expectation with those 50-some thousand people, which is about the size of a normal, the modern football stadiums. A lot of people, but I've seen more people in Washington. I came as a teenager to Washington. I remember the March on Washington and a few of the other hippie camp-ins that they had on the mall. There'd been more people there before, but I have never seen more security than we had the other day. They'd shut down the entire downtown area within about a mile of the Capitol. There were chain link fences about 8-9 foot high, walling off all the areas. And then to approach the area, you went through a chain link sort of a runway that wasn't straight. It would take you here and there. In other words, you wouldn't know where you'd come from. You were basically imprisoned as you went. Then all sorts of electronic checks and pat downs and so on. And I made the mistake of joking with one of the screeners. I said, am I in the Protestant line? Am I getting special treatment? They didn't like that. I'm sure there were Protestants in the audience, but of course there was a very high percentage of loyal Roman Catholics come to hear their pontiff speaking. But as I looked around at the environment, at the situation, I can remember seeing DC police, of course. There were Secret Service, and of course they guard the president, but you don't usually see them out and around doing crowd control. There were FBI, some plainclothes FBI, who I saw them checking in with the police. There were ATF agents in full battle gear. There were Border Patrol agents in full battle gear. There were regular military in full battle gear. There were military police with their MP things on. Who else am I missing? Basically, and there were even Coast Guard people. There was every element of the defense establishment in full battle gear, and yet the occasion didn't warrant it. And all I could see is that this was a dress rehearsal for a sort of a total lockdown. And it's not my intention in this speech to talk about that, but I do believe the unthinkable is rising up in some of these planners' minds, the unthinkable for things like martial law and controlling populations. And we clearly are in a brave new world. And part of that brave new world is the pontiff of an old world church risen to power and coming and speaking rather brusquely to the American legislators. When I started studying American history, I was very taken to read the letters that passed between President Adams and President Jefferson in their retirement. And they both died on the same day, July 4, 1826, 50 years after the establishment or Declaration of Independence. But in their old age and their growing friendship, because they'd been bitter political enemies, they discussed some of the events or theoretical future, some of the events that we're living through. And one of the items they discussed was would Christianity survive in America? Jefferson thought not. Adams said, yes, it'll survive. He says, but first, and I'm quoting as far as I can remember his exact words. He says, but first, that Hindu Kabbalistic system known as Roman Catholicism must die. At present, it has a mortal wound. When was the mortal wound? I'll check your Adventist memory. Wasn't it 1798? It was only a few years earlier for them. They'd seen it, and they believed this was a mortal wound. He says, at present, it has a mortal wound, but such is its strength that it may take 200 years more for it to die. We're 200 years down and it's not dead. And the story of how it came to life, of course, we know. Maybe I'll read you something from my own words, so I hope I'm free to read it. In Liberty magazine, we had a number of features on this at the time of the speech. You can see there's a picture of the Pope looking out over the crowd. And I wrote this at the end of an article that I'll share bits of it later. But it's worth remembering this. I actually reprinted an article from the Protestant magazine that I don't doubt you never heard of before. I hadn't, and I'm editing Liberty magazine, but our church printed as well as Liberty, Protestant magazine. It's my wife, but I have to turn her off. It's the second time it's happened. I answered her in a meeting once, and it was not good to say, I'm in a meeting now. But the Protestant magazine our church published back at the beginning of the, just before the World War I, and I picked up this article that I thought was very interesting, written by the W.W. Prescott, who had been the editor, and W.A. Spicer, his associate editor. They printed this in association with Liberty magazine, and the article was basically a collection of quotes of Catholics at that time and where they saw themselves. But let me read you what I wrote about it. It said, it might be argued that much has changed since the article was written, and I would readily concur. Just one presidential election cycle ago, Senator Rick Santorum, a dedicated Roman Catholic and a man of considerable personal integrity, startled many by declaiming that, in his words, Protestantism is absent in America today. Happily, most of the bigotry and violence against Roman Catholics that sometimes appeared in a once aggressively Protestant society has ceased. Religious freedom is extended to all, as the Constitution requires. When this article was written, the Roman Catholic Church was relatively weak, even though it had millions of adherents. Its original source of power, the Roman Empire, had long since vanished. And the strange European reincarnation of that power, the Holy Roman Empire, which also favoured the papacy, was weakened by the Protestant Reformation before being destroyed by secular forces of Napoleon Bonaparte, who took the Pope captive and removed his land possessions. Certain things have occurred since the writing of this editorial. They wrote it in 1913. In 1929, the Lateran Treaty with fascist dictator Benito Mussolini restored sovereignty to the Holy See and gave it a status as a separate state by virtue of its 110 acres. You can buy farms in Pennsylvania for as much as you and I can afford for that size. And in Australia, some of the landowners are inclined to declare themselves independent principalities, but usually not. And it says, I wrote here, it may be the smallest state in the world, but its diplomatic network is unrivaled today. Today, thanks to President Ronald Reagan, the U.S. has full diplomatic ambassadorial relations with the Vatican. Today, the Vatican is an international power broker in a manner somewhat incongruous with its spiritual role. The Second Vatican Council of 1962 to 65 brought a sea change to the Roman Catholic Church, as it attempted to deal with a myriad of modern challenges, both within and without the Church. In particular, the document Dignitatis Humanae countered the historic actions and dogma of the Church by affirming the right of all to believe according to conscience and acknowledging a right to change religious affiliation. That was massive for the Catholic Church to even state that. That was followed by the 1999 papal document, Memory and Reconciliation, which attempted to disavow the Church actions of other times. Things like the persecution of the Jews, the Crusades and the Inquisition. As a result, the Roman Catholic Church is emerging as somewhat of a modern-day champion of religious liberty. And this is my clincher here. But history cannot be so easily disregarded, as the world wonders at the new found prestige of an old entity.
The present Pope spoke before the US Congress as a moral saviour. We should respect his opinion and the rights of his many fellow Roman Catholics in that body and in the nation as a whole. We should also remember history, past stated aims and present equivocations like the model of subsidiarity stated by Rome that might turn the elevated status of spiritual life into the overlordship of a religio-political power. America was once a Protestant society for good doctrinal and historic reasons. Why the change? And America was once a stubbornly secular power for many of the same reasons. So we're witnessing a huge shift. Just forget Sunday law and other things that we know will follow eventually, but just to have this figure elevated and given a platform in this once Protestant country, it's huge. It's unprecedented till now, and it speaks, a whole wall full of volumes about the power and prestige of a power that was once antithetical to pretty much everything that this country stood for. Not just religion. It's not my wife. Let me tell you a little anecdote. There's lots of anecdotes here that illustrate pretty well, I think, what's going on. Since I was here last time, I know, I went along to an all-day seminar at Catholic University on religious liberty, put on by the Roman Catholic Church. In fact, it was intended just for Roman Catholics. You know, it wasn't a lockout, so you couldn't come if you're not a Catholic, but it was not intended for them, and there were very few non-Catholics there. And I went along and got myself invited because I wanted to hear Cardinal Dolan, the Archbishop of New York, and the head of the Catholic bishops at the time, and a possible pope. I really did think he would likely be elected pope because it would have brought the U.S. under papal power in a way that they've been struggling to do. And I wanted to hear him speak. So I came with a couple of Adventist laymen, and we sat at a round table right under the lectern. So when Dolan got up, I mean, I could almost look into the whites of his eyes. And he held forth quite articulately on the importance of religious liberty and how they were challenging the Obama administration on the healthcare mandate. I don't think it's a valid thing, but at least that's how they were applying their newfound leadership in religious liberty. And he was holding forth, and while I'm watching, I saw him do something that I don't know if you can see it in me, but I know it. Sometimes when people are talking and they know their topic, they're just sort of, it's buffered and they're just talking and they're having a little conversation inside. I could see it. He was really somewhere else mulling something over. And he finished his thought and he stopped. And he looked at his Catholic audience and this is what he said. He said, you know, he said, there was a time when Roman Catholics would not have spoken this way about religious liberty, religious freedom. He said, we once held that error has no rights. And then he continued and finished up quickly. And what was very interesting, he flopped down, then he came down off and flopped down next to us, looked at us all happy. Didn't, you know, we were probably priests for all he knew. And so quickly I told him about liberty, and I invited him along to come to a dinner at the GC, but I found out that that doesn't sit well with some other people. But what was interesting when I asked him, he said, sure, I'll come. But he said, you people, you won't have the right thing for me to drink, will you? And I joked with him. I said, we'll have something appropriate. But in that one little joke, I knew why he did it. He was saying, I know you people. I know you. The session ended with his speech. And there was a little break, and then they picked up with the next session. It was an all-day seminar. The next seminar, I don't know the topic that was listed, but there was a Catholic Charities person, there was a theologian, there was a historian, and
think there was one other person up front. And they spent the entire time answering the audience. First question, what is the cardinal talking about? And they had to be told. But you might need to remember that that has been indeed the default setting for the Roman Catholic Church. What has changed is Vatican II. And they were told, and most Catholics didn't seem well aware of it, that it was Vatican II and this document, Dignitatis Humanae, put up by an American a Jesuit priest that changed everything for the Catholic Church. What they weren't told is that there's a rear guard war being fought in the Roman Catholic Church through the last three popes against Vatican II. Popes John Paul II and Benedict both had something to do with it and regretted it and were rolling it back. And the way I would express it to Adventists, it's not an insincere statement, although they apply it with a bias from power and so on when they talk about the right of people to choose their religion and so on. I don't think it's insincere, but it's at risk because their default setting is bubbling up more and more, and when they repudiate that, watch out. Because as the Cardinal said, their default setting is they do not allow you the right to be wrong. If you're wrong, you have no rights. So with that background, Francis got up and took an interesting talk, and those Adventists that paid attention, I don't think were overly worried by it. They didn't realise the references that he made throughout the whole speech to his own documents and documents of his predecessors. He did make allusions to his ongoing campaign to bring in the Family Rest Day. He made an allusion to him speaking at the Institute of the Family, I think it was the next day in Philadelphia. He has been promoting very heavily a Family Rest Day, which, wonder of wonders, it happens to be Sunday. Whereas an ecological, societally ecological move to save energy, to save human resources and to rejuvenate society, all work would cease and people would be encouraged to go to church. I mean, that's the Sunday law light. But the way it's being presented, it's not overtly religious and it has all of the buzzwords of ecology and energy saving and saving society from meltdown and so on. Who's against it? I've never heard anybody speak against it. That was there. When he stood up, if you listen to his speech, first of all, he gave the sign. And I know a lot of the pop stars are inclined to do it too, so it might not be definitive, but it was a little chilling for me to see him give a three-position 666 sign. You got to face it, that's going on. But then he did something that I think was an incredibly in-your-face statement for Protestant America. He based his speech on four individuals, two Roman Catholics, and I'll mention them a little later, and two American historical figures. The Roman Catholics were Americans, and he wanted to plant them in the American narrative. But he had reasons for why he mentioned those particular two Catholics. The other two he mentioned was Martin Luther King, which resonated nicely with his theme of social justice, anti-capitalism, and it was an in-your-face speech to the American system. But the first person he mentioned was Abraham Lincoln, 150th anniversary, he said, of Abraham Lincoln's assassination. Do any of you remember your history? How was Abraham Lincoln assassinated? All that you read in a high school history book is the most one-dimensional story about that assassination. That was John Wilkes Booth that shot him and then jumped over the parapet there and broke his ankle and fled and was caught a few days later and hung. But the history is very plain. It's not a secret history. It's just people don't repeat it. There were 11 people implicated in a conspiracy, not just to kill Abraham Lincoln, but to bring down the entire government. Because on the same night as Abraham Lincoln was shot, the Secretary of State was stabbed many times by another one of the plotters. He survived. Another one was delegated to kill General Grant, but he was out of town. There were 11 plotters. Four of them were hanged, and four others got life sentences. It was a plot that was centred around the boarding house of Mary Surrette. And all but one of them were Roman Catholics, and that person was in the process of converting. Mary Surrette's brother, who was actually a Southern spy, he escaped, fled to Canada, where he was sheltered by priests, and then he made his way to Rome, where he joined the papal bodyguard. So this is not such a distant story from Roman interests. At the same time that the Pope of Rome had been fulminating against the American experiment, there was a number of complex political reasons why he was offended by the desire of the US to maintain the Union. It's not really a matter of whether it was a Jesuit plot or a Roman Catholic plot. The point is, at the time, it was thought to be, and the evidence was overwhelming that this involved an awful lot of Roman Catholics. Why would the Bishop of Rome, 150 years later, wave him in front of Protestant America? I don't even know the answer to it. All I can think of is the provocation. They are so sure of this place that they don't think anyone will notice. Remember, it was Senator Santorum who said, Protestantism is absent in America. An amazing speech, really. And he used little buzzwords like reciprocal subsidiarity. He says it's called for. If you read Liberty magazine, you'll know that's a buzzword of the Roman Catholic Church at the moment. And subsidiarity is their way of speaking to the separation of church and state. They believe, ironically, what the religious right, Protestant religious right, disavow now. They believe in the separation of church and state. But on their own terms, they say there should be a separation of church and state where the state is subsidiary to the church. In other words, they're separate, but the church is poised here to invoke its superior power whenever possible. So what does reciprocal subsidiarity mean? He spoke of it in his speech. It's mind-boggling to me that we were given such a speech. Then the two Roman Catholics that he promoted. There was Dorothy Day. She was a leader in the Catholic worker movement. But she was a radical socialist, one of the most radical political activists in early American history. She believed in civil disobedience, distributionism. You heard President Obama talk about that lately, redistributing the wealth. These were the ideas that she pushed. And I have learned from studying the documents out of Rome, nothing is by chance. They didn't just choose someone who had something that might be embarrassing. They chose her because of that. I'm certain of it. The other person was Thomas Merton. He was a Cistercian monk who was a mystic. And curiously, he was most involved with Buddhism and Eastern religions. Remember, the Dalai Lama had been turned down just a few months earlier. He was into mystical Eastern religions and comparative religions. Do you remember what our General Conference President warned about since his first election? And it's a huge problem now. Is spiritual formation or mystical contemplative exercises. Do you remember your history of the Jesuits, Ignatius Loyola? There were two things that characterized Ignatius Loyola forming the Jesuit order. It was to have radical foot soldiers to roll back the Reformation. He was an ex-soldier himself. So that was a very overt characteristic of the Jesuits. The other was that he was a highly mystical individual, and not just in a free-floating sense. You can go and read the spiritual exercises that Ignatius Loyola recommended. Those are being promoted. And remember what Ellen White says about at the end of time, there will be this union of Catholicism and Protestantism and spiritualism. We are seeing it front and center. Like I say, radical social justice from the woman and radical spiritualistic exercises from the man that he recommended in the mainstream of America. Quite amazing. Quite amazing. And yet, when I came back that same day and had a meeting, I made some comments, and a couple of people on the committee that I was on, they laughed at me. They said, "Oh, he's not bringing the Sunday law. You think he's bringing the Sunday law, don't you?" And I said, "I don't think he's bringing the Sunday law. You haven't read The Great Controversy, have you? Because Great Controversy never says that the Pope brings, in the sense of compels, the Sunday law on the United States. He does what he has already done. He rises to prominence, subverts the Protestant message here, introduces the idea, and his whole prestige is behind it. And at that point, the people clamour to the legislators for the Sunday law. There's a clamour that's going to come. So we need to be careful. Nobody should say and ever has said that Rome is going to take over the United States. But it's predicted that the world would wonder after this power that's reinstated. And a once Protestant country will totally change its viewpoint. Let me read you a couple of the quotes that our editors of 1913 dug up from Roman Catholicism at that time. Remember, Roman Catholicism in the valley of powerlessness from the imprisonment by General Berthier of the Pope of Rome and taking away his lands and his political power, and then the reinstatement in the 1930s by Benito Mussolini. Here's a couple of the quotes. One of them from the New World, a Catholic magazine of 1905 in Chicago. Says, "There has never been a period in American history when the church's opportunity has been so close to her. To a great extent, the ancient antagonisms have died. Protestantism is disintegrating before our eyes. The moment is ripe to build a Catholic America, broader and stronger and nobler and truer than any empire the world has yet seen. And strong men are now laying the foundation." And here's another one. This is from a paper on church extension and convert making by the Reverend Kelly of the Church Extension Society. He says, "Without a doubt, if American Protestantism were blotted off the religious map of the world, the work of the so-called reformers of the 15th century within 50 years might well be called dead. From a strategic point of view, America, the United States of America, is our best missionary field." These are interesting quotes. You know, they have a right to say them, but they're very telling. And here's another one from a letter in the Missionary Magazine of 1910. It says, "It seems to me that the main support of Protestantism comes from the United States and England. If we put an end to this effort in England and the United States by making nations predominantly Catholic, we will have removed the chief obstacle to the conversion of the whole world to the true faith. A vigorous effort in the United States at this time will reduce the opposition to an insignificant condition. In the course of another century," we're 105 years on from when this was written, "in the course of another century, the Protestant sects will be a study for the historian and antiquarian along with Arianism." And the last one I want to read, he says, Reverend Doyle, he says, "How near at hand do you think is the time when America will be dominantly Catholic? We must labor to gain the confidence, love, and respect of the American people. This once gained, the Catholic Church is on her way to claim the American heart, and it may carry 1,000 dogmas on her back." Interesting. You can put it down to just bold talking, but it's been worked out by history. We are at that point they look forward to. And you know, on one level, of course, we shouldn't have an antagonistic attitude. Of course, we should see them as fellow Christians, obviously in a deception that we're uncomfortable with. And You know, I meet with many Roman Catholics that are wonderful people. But as Ellen White says, Rome is unchanged. It is the same entity. It is set against the Protestant reformers. I don't know if I mentioned it last time I was here, but it's worth repeating in this context. Pope Benedict, when he began his pontificate, got into trouble with the Muslims by giving a speech at Regensburg University. And to this day, I've never read anything that really identifies that speech correctly. It's all characterized by the offense that they took. But he gave an example of Islam as violent only to set the scene. Because once that was in place, then he made a statement that's wrong, but it's his premise. He says, Christianity too was once violent. Well, you and I know that Christianity in the early days, shortly after Christ, when there was martyrdom, when they were tackling the Roman Empire, they were not violent. They were so passive that the Romans felt little unnerved that they would go willingly to the lions. But the Pope says they were violent. You accept that, and his premise follows. He says Christianity too was once violent until it adopted rational Hellenism. Or Hellenistic rationality, I think is the way he puts it. In other words, the Greek culture and its logical underpinnings became infused into Christianity, and it took away the tendency toward violence. Then his whole speech was just 4 points to show how that violent tendency was bubbling up again. He gave, I think it was 3 points for secularism, and Benedict was always worried about secularism as a threat. But his first point was very telling. He said, the reformers, and he meant the Protestant reformers, the reformers, by their insistence on sola scriptura, exposed Christianity once again to violence. Now, we've lived a few, not just years, but incidents since then. What do you think of when you think of people that are so committed to their holy book that they'll commit violent acts? That's radical Islam that we're dealing with. And he was equating a Protestant view of sola scriptura with that same sort of dynamic that is affronting the world and the driving dynamic between homeland security and all of the clampdowns on civil liberties. I am quite sure that we're in a dynamic that at its end point will have not just Islam, but all non-mainstream religions, and particularly those Protestants who insist on the Bible as their point of authority. These groups will be classed together with radical Islam as violent extremists who are not fit to live and are a mortal threat to everything that we cherish about modern society. This is the game they're playing. I'm certain of it, and I read it in everything. What lay behind the Pope's speech before Congress, though, were a couple of recent documents. One of them that came out in... the first one that came out was actually under his predecessor in 2009, Caritas in Veritate. Anyone remember that? None of us are high on Latin, but it was Charity in Truth. And it was an interesting document. To me, it was the most interesting, well, not most interesting, the most secular of any I'd seen till that point. Some of the many documents that come out from the different popes are very arcane, convoluted documents. You've really got to get your thinking cap on to even follow their logic sometimes. But this one was relatively easy to understand because in it, Benedict attacked or tackled every ill of the modern world. Things like even pawn shops are mentioned. Sorry, that's in the next one. But things like labor unions, matters of sovereignty, unemployment, the environment was mentioned there too. Pretty much the whole deal. And I'll read you something that I think gives an idea of where it ended up. This is toward the end. He says, in the face of the unrelenting growth of global interdependence, there is a strongly felt need, even in the midst of a global recession. Remember, he wrote it in 2009, right after the recession, and he gave a copy of it to Obama.
for reform of the United Nations organization and likewise of economic institutions and international finance. Which was odd for him to say that because I'm old enough to remember the Banco Ambrosiano scandal. And it's long since proven that the Vatican Bank is implicated in all sorts of nefarious stuff around the world. But he says there's a reform. And likewise of economic institutions and international finances so that the concept of the family of nations can acquire real teeth. One also senses the urgent need to find innovative ways of implementing the principle of the responsibility to protect and of giving poorer nations an effective voice in shared decision making. This seems necessary in order to arrive at a political, juridical, and economic order which can increase and give direction to international cooperation for the development of all peoples in solidarity. You know what he's talking about, it's globalism. Next sentence. To manage the global economy, to revive economies hit by the crisis, to avoid any deterioration of the present crisis and the greater imbalances that would result, to bring about integral and timely disarmament, food security and peace, to guarantee the protection of the environment and to regulate migration. For all this, listen to this, there is urgent need of a true world political authority. As my predecessor, Blessed John the 23rd, indicated some years ago, such an authority would need to be regulated by law to observe consistently the principles of subsidiarity and solidarity, to seek to establish the common good. That's another theme, which is basically the latest version of better that one man that should die than that the whole nation should perish. Common good. To make a commitment to securing authentic, integral human development inspired by the values of charity and truth. Furthermore, this is the clincher, such an authority would need to be universally recognized and to be vested with the effective power to ensure security for all, regard for justice and respect for rights. Obviously, it would have to have the authority to ensure compliance with its decisions from all parties. And I'm fishing for the statement, it's not here, but it's later on. He says it needs to have the power to act and to enforce. And one of the magazines that I read regularly, now I can't remember the name. Anyhow, it's a political magazine, nothing to do with religion. When they reviewed this as though it was just a political proposal, and they gave it pretty good marks. And then the reviewer at the end said, the trouble is, he said, if you accept this document, the Pope comes with it. He is the indispensable part of this. And when he's talking about a powerful global authority with the power to act and to enforce, I mean, how does that differ from what we read from Revelation? It's prophecy fulfilling before our eyes, I believe. I mean, you don't have to get pejorative against the Pope just to see this is a plan that is fulfilling prophecy, and even if there are good intentions, it's based on a wrong premise. Based on a very wrong premise. The other document that did precede the Pope's speech, and he alluded to it a number of times, is Laudato Si. Praise be to you, my Lord. And I'll read you a couple of paragraphs. I can interpret it, but I'd like you to hear the words. At the beginning, he says, more than 50 years ago, with the world teetering on the brink of nuclear crisis, Pope St. John the 23rd wrote an encyclical which not only rejected war, but offered a proposal for peace. Now, faced as we are with global environmental deterioration, I wish to address every person living on this planet. So this is not a document to Catholics. It's a world document. He says, I would like to enter into dialogue with all people about our common home. And this is what he says. Through Noah, who remained innocent and just, God decided to open a path of salvation. In this way, he gave humanity the chance of a new beginning. All it takes is one good person to restore hope.
The biblical tradition clearly shows that this renewal entails recovering and respecting the rhythms inscribed in nature by the hand of the Creator. We see this, for example, in the law of the Sabbath. On the seventh day, God rested from all his work. He commanded Israel to set aside each seventh day as a day of rest, a Sabbath. There you go, the Pope's pushing the Sabbath day. A little later, he hits it again. He says, along these same lines, rest on the seventh day is meant not only for human beings, but also so that your ox and your donkey may have rest. Remember, I'm talking about the family rest day? Everything comes to a halt. Clearly, he says, the Bible has no place for a tyrannical anthropocentrism unconcerned for other creatures. So he said, Peter and all of those concerns. And he says, why should this document, addressed to all peoples of goodwill, include a chapter dealing with the convictions of believers? I am well aware that in the area of politics and philosophy, there are those who firmly reject the idea of a creator, or consider it irrelevant and consequently dismiss as irrational the risk contributions which religions can make toward an integral ecology and the full development of humanity. Others view religion simply as a subculture to be tolerated. Nonetheless, science and religion, with their distinctive approaches to understanding reality, can enter into an intense dialogue fruitful for both. Remember, Ellen White says that science will be shown at the end of time to lead toward a false religion. And back to Sunday, last paragraph I'm going to read. He says, on Sunday, our participation in the Eucharist has special importance. Sunday, like the Jewish Sabbath, is meant to be a day which heals our relationships with God, with ourselves, with others, and with the world. Sunday is the day of resurrection, the first day of the new creation, whose first fruits are the Lord's risen humanity, the pledge of the final transfiguration of all created reality. It also proclaims man's eternal rest in God. In this way, Christian spirituality incorporates the value of relaxation and festivity. He's talking about the family rest day. We tend to demean contemplative rest as something unproductive and unnecessary, but this is to do away with the very thing which is most important about work, its meaning. And remember the other document dealt with labour relations and so on. He's tackling everything all at once. He says, the law of weekly rest forbade work on the seventh day, so that your ox and your donkey may have rest, and the son of your maidservant and the stranger may be refreshed. Rest opens our eyes to the larger picture and gives us renewed sensitivity to the rights of others. And so, the day of rest, centered in the Eucharist, not on the Jewish Sabbath, sheds its light on the whole week and motivates us to greater concern for nature and the poor. So don't think just because the Pope didn't mention even the family rest day by name or the Sunday rest day that that wasn't what he was talking about in his speech to the Congress. I mean, to me it's mind-boggling that a Protestant nation not just listened to it because you have to be polite. He shouldn't have been shouted down. He shouldn't have been invited there. But why the comment didn't arise after the fact. I have not read anybody noticing this. And not even in our own church, hardly. I notice Ed Reed has recorded some thoughts on this, and maybe there's some others. But generally speaking, I have hardly spoken to Adventists who noticed anything untoward in his speech. About the best they can come up with, well, sort of a sign of the times. We should pay attention to what's being said. With other documents that came out of Rome, they'd sort of stolen a march on us where proof texting alone will not answer their point. And I believe, which the Bible says anyhow, the real issue is one of authority. Who has the right to determine, or from what point of authority do you get your day of worship? Is it from the Bible? Sola Scriptura? You might be violently inclined if you persist in that too much. Or is it from the church fathers and the authority of the greatest leader in Christendom? Seems sort of safe to Congress members. You know, he's the figure they look into his eyes as past president did and can see God even, so they don't question him. But it's worth remembering, apart from theology or prophecy, how did the Pope of Rome get to his present point? I love history, and it's a mystery to me why there's such easy acceptance of the claims of Rome. Remember, the early Christian church had bishops or main churches in any number of centres of the Roman Empire. Rome, it's true, was the capital of the Roman Empire at the time of Christ's death and resurrection. But it didn't last for long. Anybody want to guess how long Rome's influence or its predominance lasted? It only lasted for another 3 centuries after Christ, because around the year 312, the Emperor Constantine, the same Constantine who ostensibly became a Christian, legalized Christianity and gave it his imprimatur and recommended that they worship on Sunday. But Constantine actually moved the capital of Rome. I think today people have forgotten that. Rome was in collapse, and the city of Rome was becoming a backwater, and he literally moved the whole capital, just like Brasilia years ago when I was a kid. They just planted a capital in the middle of the jungle. And the Emperor Constantine took the capital, the seat of power of Rome, and planted it where modern-day Constantinople is. There were not but a few villages there at that time. He made the imperial city from scratch. I was just there a few days ago on the way back from Israel. And it's impressive to see the remainders of imperial Rome there, and in particular the Hagia Sophia, main church of Christendom was built around the year 500. For about 1,000 years, it was the singular largest cathedral for the Christian world. Remember St. Peter's, that iconic cathedral that we see in all of the papal appearances now. That was only built at the time of Martin Luther. In fact, it was built with the indulgences that Luther objected to in the 1500s. But Hagia Sophia, this massive, nearly 2,000-year-old church, or 1,800-year-old church, that was the religious seat of Christianity under the Roman church. And how it hasn't remained so is an interesting story. Two things interceded. First of all, a fight between the bishops of Rome and Constantinople, which culminated in the Bishop of Rome excommunicating his rival. So that was in the year 1054. I had to look closely at it, because for me that's close to 1066 when England fell to the Normans. But 1054, Rome literally attacked at the time, the main seat of religious power in the Roman Empire, in the capital, Constantinople, not Rome. Then something else happened that Rome apologized to a few years ago, and I don't think a person in a million understood what they were talking about, but they apologized for the sack of Constantinople, because the Fourth Crusade, which ran from 1202 to 1204, was directed by Rome and the Doges of Venice, was directed, rather than going to the Holy Land, to go and attack Constantinople. So the Bishop of Rome used military force to overthrow his competitor. And those crusaders actually conquered and pillaged Constantinople. And for just a couple of years, as you look in the history, and you can see it, it became a Roman Catholic Church from 1204, the end of that Fourth Crusade, to 1261. And then after that, the Ottoman Turks took over. And, of course, the whole empire collapsed. But to me, it's a curious fact of history. How would just one of at least 2 major churches in the early Christian church, and not the one under the final smile of the empire anyhow, how could it pass itself off as the singular dominant power? I mean, there's not an easy answer to that, but it's not an automatic thing. It's not easily explained just, well, St. Peter was given the keys of heaven and hell, and that God is behind them. But it goes a lot toward explaining their sense of authority. They've exercised aggressive power, both politically and religiously, and while they've gone through a period of disempowerment at the moment, they are riding high. And it's worth, I don't have the quotes with me, but it's worth remembering what Ellen White said in Great Controversy about Rome not changing, the old heresies, the old paganisms are really with us today. And I probably shouldn't say it, well, it is in a semi-mockery way, but it just amazes me every time a Pope of Rome comes to the United States, it's happening more and more often, they have the stave with this stub or the sunburst. Have you seen it? It's called the monstrance. It's a sunburst that was used by the priests of sun worship and Mithraism before the Christian church. And he comes here and he waves that in front of Protestant America and nobody seems to notice. It's mind-boggling to me. Mind-boggling. That is as open a symbol as you can get of sun worship. The flaming rays of the sun in a big ball. And it's not a secret, you study it. I mean, you look it up, you'll find that's exactly what it means. It's the sunburst and a reminder of worship of the sun. And then it just goes ballistic from there. You can go online and you can listen to masses where they allowing for the imprecision of, I mean, it is precise, but I mean, in our day, the imprecision of understanding Latin. But there's Latins that extol Lucifer, that he will never be defeated. I mean, everything possible is being recycled and spat out. And I think, if nothing else, this is designed to show people of some perception and of biblical interest that here, this system that speaks so kindly and so rationally contains within it very paganism itself. That's what we should remind ourselves as a Seventh Adventist. And of course, when it's thwarted, as it has been a few times in the past, it's likely to reach for force, not its own force if it can avoid it, but the force of a compliant organization like the United States. And I hope that what I saw the day that the Pope spoke, all of the security forces brought out, I hope that's not a direct harbinger of the future, but I'm afraid it probably is. That he now speaks with such authority and such the imprimatur of the powers that be, that you don't oppose it. Who can stand against, isn't that what the Bible says? Who can stand against this entity? Who has the power to stand against him? And yet, if we recognize that authority resides in God's word, and that God is the ultimate authority, no man can usurp God, then I think we're protected. But we need to go to the Word. I have been studying lately a lot of the stuff on Roman Catholic websites. And as I say, there's very many good people. And there actually is a rise in spirituality in Roman Catholicism. And I think that many of Roman Catholic members are being prepared for a new biblical openness, where they're looking more critically than they used to. Not in the critical sense, but they're just curiosity is aroused, and they don't just take things. And on one site, though, I found a very interesting discussion that challenges what Protestants have said and Roman and Seventh-day Adventists have often repeated. The fact that Rome doesn't seem to want, or hasn't seemed in the past to have wanted, the average person to read the Bible. I mean, it's pretty easy to prove from history that in the medieval times, when books were very expensive and reading and writing were not throughout the whole population, the Bible was kept up where they wouldn't go on the altar, and it was under lock and key or with a chain on it, was not accessible to the average person. That has changed now. And on the Catholic websites, I'm finding a very interesting discussion. They say it's not true, as we've said, that the Catholic Church never wanted people to read the Bible. And they give a nod to the fact that literacy was low in the medieval period, and you know they were trying to protect ignorant people from just partial knowledge. But they say the Bible exists only because of the Catholic Church protecting it all during these years, and that through various church councils, the Roman Catholic Church assembled what is acceptable books to make up the Bible, and that thanks to them we have a Bible. And further they say, which goes to their claims, that it was on the authority of the Roman Catholic Church that they had the right and the innate authority of to know what to choose. Now that's an interesting claim, not inconsistent with what they've always said, but it's not what we're used to. And as I said, I think earlier this morning, proof texting is not an easy answer to that. But the easiest answer is question their authority. They have three levels of authority that are routinely restated in Rome. There's the Holy Scriptures, there is the tradition, and which includes the Church Fathers and the leadership, the Pope. It's not necessarily one or the other, but it's a combination. And it seems to me from reading my Bible, as partially determined as it might have been by church councils that were controlled by the Catholic Church, the authority of man, the traditions of man, are never extolled as equal to the clear word of God. The best defense we can have within the scriptures is to compare scripture with scripture. But we need to do what Rome criticized and the Pope of Rome criticized. We need to go back to sola scriptura. I'm certain of it. Not that we've departed from it, but re-emphasize it. Put that up as the key authority, because this battle is between a self-proclaimed authority, a self-proclaimed kingship, rulership, moral leadership of the world, and a biblically based a battle plan, if you like, for God's people who should hang on every word of his that's through, the time-tested assemblage of words that there's many ways of coming at it, not least of which I saw in Israel, the Dead Sea Scrolls. We've got any number of verifications that these ancient words are true, and we shouldn't have to rely, as Rome keeps reminding us, on the authority of this council or that council when they assembled it. They were recognizing the obvious at the time. And if you study the history, which very few people seem to do, there were some ins and outs, and even Martin Luther didn't seem overly keen on Revelation, or James for that matter. But in the long scheme of things, we can be very sure of the basic package we have, and we should be extremely cynical and suspicious of any entity that says, it doesn't matter what it says there, my authority supersedes that. And by the way, it's an interesting fact of history, but the papal infallibility, while it, practically speaking, was in long development, it was not formally put forward until 1870. That's an interesting time frame. Our Adventist Church was formed around about that time. As truth and Protestant revival and the remnant concept was brought forward through the early Adventist outgrowth of the Great Awakening in this country, it appears that Rome was actually restating the old errors. Back to the speech of the Pope. I made a statement somewhere, and I've got to find it now. But, I came back just buzzed about it. How could this happen in Protestant America? I'm old enough to remember when John Kennedy was elected president, and given that he was just a short enough office to leave a myth rather than a track record, he seemed a good enough president. But when he was running for president, Adventists were rattled. We thought that this was Rome inserting itself politically into the United States. And it could have been. But he gave wonderful speeches on the separation of church and state. He says, I'm not going to allow any prelate or church leader to tell me what to do. And he pretty much stayed with that. But what is very telling to me is that in the last two elections, the bishops of the Roman Catholic Church in America have actually said very overtly that they made a mistake with John F. Kennedy in not requiring him to hew to the dictates of his church, and they will not make that same mistake twice. Again, that is ominous. And we need to, there's not much we can do, but we need to be perceptive of these developments and to see in these developments the outgrowth of prophecy and the ever louder footsteps of a coming, well, it might be a Sunday law, but what it really is religious coercion. Religious coercion. When we talk about religious liberty, it's something God-given. It's something relates to, you know, the whole message of Jesus to bring liberation from sin. But the easiest litmus test to apply on religious liberty, it's not whether it's a Sunday law or a Sabbath law. You know, you could have a Sabbath law. I mean, some of us might want someone to be elected and to bring that in. But whatever it is, if there's coercion involved, if someone is required to do what's against their conscience, if they're required by force rather than by personal choice, that is against the principles of religious liberty as it's described here by all activists, and it's against the principles of religious liberty as God laid them out for us, starting with Eden, in the Garden of Eden, when he gave Adam and Eve the choice. I mean, it's a horrible choice they made. Bad things followed from it, but he didn't stop them making that choice. And I hope and pray that we don't see soon, but when we do, that we'll recognize even this country entering into that dynamic, that we will react to it and cry liberty throughout the land. We should not be passive to these things. You know, we're not called to be martyrs in the sense that we just throw ourselves at the flame. But when there's a wrong abroad, when there's a bad dynamic and the country is drifting toward the old model, we need to say something. And you can say it both to your neighbours, your workmates, and your friends, relatives. You can write letters to the newspaper. You can, you know, there's many ways that we can communicate, as any citizen in any country can. We need to cry aloud, spare not, because if we don't speak out now, when when things are really ratcheted up tight, we might find that it's either impossible or near impossible to speak truth to power. We're in the phase now, I'm certain of it, when this bold power is speaking, you know, old heresies in the guise of new things. Like, how more modern can you be than talking about the environment and ecological survival? You know, how much more contemporary could you be than to talk about nation states which are collapsing? You know, it's failed states that are troubling the United States and others around the world. They're talking about these things, but their solution is basically a Christian form of the caliphate. It gets people's attention when you say it, but it doesn't differ much at all. And the last discussion I had before this meeting was someone mentioning the rise of Turkey and maybe an Islamic power that connects in Adventist minds to the discussion that our church had before the turn of the last century, in the late 1890s. It transfixed Seventh-day Adventists. What would happen at the end of time to Turkey? They never thought that Turkey would collapse because they believed that the harassment of Muslims toward Christians that had characterized the Ottoman Turkish Empire would continue to the very end of time and be part of the end time dynamic. Turkey as an entity collapsed, but in a very real way, we're living through a huge religious conflict between radical Islam and increasingly radical Christianity, or politically radical Christianity, and it's very likely that we will see some cosmic battles played out, not just battles for the heart and mind, but literal battles. And the prize is a world and the allegiance of the world, whether they will follow a self-proclaimed power or the conscience and the guidelines of God through His scriptures. Thank you for listening to me, and keep reading Liberty Magazine. Keep following current events. There are incredible things in development at the moment. Things are moving very fast.
You have been listening to another special American Christian Ministries presentation. International copyright, all rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americanchristianministry.org. There you will discover the largest selection of authentic Adventist preaching available. You can trust ACM. There's no compromise here. If American Christian Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage you. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He is coming soon.